Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we focus on a ruling handed down by the Hawaii Supreme Court in a case that offers a way forward for some HMSA patients to seek redress if they are denied treatment. We hear about a domestic violence program on Kauai that loses its federal funding today. Can it keep its doors open? Artificial intelligence is making its way in the state auditor's office, but in a way that might surprise you. Beauty in the eye of the beholder. We talk about mural art and some pushback by students. And we remember a member of our HPR Ohana who we lost this week. It is Wednesday, September 24th, day 7 of our fall membership campaign. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we get the latest on a lawsuit that we've been tracking from the start. When Hilo attorney Ted Hong filed a complaint against HMSA years ago, he likened it to a David versus Goliath case. HMSA is the largest health insurer in the state. The suit had to do with pre-authorization of health care coverage for its members. Hong represented families whose doctors prescribed treatment that was initially denied by the insurer. The case went up to the Hawaii Supreme Court, which this week issued a ruling that changes the playing field. Here's Hong unpacking the decision for us when we talked to him this morning.
Certainly, we're very grateful that the Supreme Court, Justice McKenna, took such a deep dive into this particular case and sifting through all the factual and legal issues and the procedural issues as well. The takeaway from this case, this decision on the macro level and the micro level, and the easiest way to start this is on the micro level, as individuals, the three individuals, Dr. Nita as a patient, Ms. Orsino as a patient, and also Mr. Norton as patients, the ruling clears the way for them to continue their lawsuit against HMSA for the wrongful denial of their doctor's requests. Their doctors requested certain treatment, certain procedures, certain drugs, and they denied it, and bad things, very bad things, life-changing, tragic things happened to them. And now the court has said that they can pursue those. On the macro level, the court said that if you want to look at these HMSA contracts, you have to basically use another vehicle to do that. And that would be focusing on the unconscionability of contracts between the providers and HMSA.
The concern was that Dr. Nita's patient was denied treatment.
Dr. Nita's patient was Charlene Orsino. Dr. Nita prescribed nifedipine as to delay her labor, premature labor, and HMSA denied it. The result of that case is she was medevac to Honolulu and gave birth to an extremely dangerously premature baby who, as a result, has been left with a number of physical and mental deficiencies, to put it mildly.
And point of clarification, because wasn't there a patient also that you had represented that died?
Yeah, that's Mr. Norton, Scotty Norton. So in Scotty Norton's case, he had a different doctor who, based on Scotty's presentation, wanted to do an MRI because he was concerned about cancer. And the HMSA clerks refused to grant or permit Scotty from getting an MRI. And instead, what they did was they said that all HMSA would pay for and recommends is physical treatment, physical therapy. So he went to a physical therapist. And Thor, as in the Norse god, his son would take Scotty Norton to the physical therapist for the physical therapy sessions. And they were so excruciatingly painful that Scotty would be screaming. It was like torture. And there are a couple of times where Scotty, the dad, was begging his son, don't take me there. I don't want to go in there. So finally, HMSA relented, gave him an MRI, and they found it was basically metastasized prostate cancer. Went into his bones, his organs, everything. By that time, it was just a matter of how many months he's had left. And that was the downfall or the bad thing that happened to Scotty Norton because of some clerk saying that he couldn't get an MRI.
And so going forward then, if there are patients out there and doctors who have an issue with this whole pre-authorization policy going forward, this ruling gives them some relief.
Absolutely. One of the concerns was, okay, HMSA has this arbitration process. They even have an expedited arbitration process, which takes months. So in Charlene's case, she gave birth premature. She was medevaced within maybe a week after, or days after, HMSA refused to allow her to get nifedipine to delay her labor. But the upshot of this decision is it leaves patients who have been denied coverage the opportunity to bring it to court. And although people automatically think, oh my gosh, court falls into a big, deep black hole in terms of time, actually, we can go to court, we can file the complaint and file an injunctive relief motion to have it heard in an expedited manner. So people think of an injunction as the court saying, you can't do this. But an injunctive relief is actually a double-edged sword. The court could say, no, HMSA, you have to do this, or you must do this. How that would work is patients would go in and file a complaint against HMSA in court, file the injunctive relief motion, and then the court would issue a decision, and then within 10 days there would be a hearing under the rules. So conceivably, patients can get a quicker answer than utilizing HMSA's slanted arbitration process, an expedited arbitration process.
Just any thoughts about this decision? I know you were hoping that it would go further, but anything else that maybe listeners need to take away from this?
It's a work in progress. The court did, however, gave us the roadmap in terms of what to do if we wanted to really challenge the unconscionability of the HMSA provider agreements. One of the issues that still is on the table is who makes the decisions regarding your health care? Is it going to be some clerk on the fifth floor of HMSA, or is it going to be your doctor? And our contention has always been from the beginning, it should be the doctor making these calls, not HMSA. I know HMSA screams and goes, oh my gosh, the horror, the cost, with doctors making all these decisions. But my point is, HMSA has structured healthcare in this state so that, unfortunately, it is so hugely expensive and the process is unwieldy and there needs to be a change. Are we going to get a change from our legislators? Doubt it. I mean, you know, every campaign cycle, they're taking money from HMSA. So really, we need to focus in and try and reset the balance between the providers, the patients, and the insurance companies.
That was Ted Hong, a Big Island attorney who sued HMSA over its contracts with doctors. We did reach out to HMSA for a reaction to the ruling. We were told it had no comment at this time. And full disclosure, HPR is an underwriter, or HMSA is an underwriter for HPR.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University. Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters La Piha Makahiki, a 100% ka'u blend with notes of strawberry jam, brown sugar, and sweet lime at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
Today, over Story Hawaii has a story about the local impacts of federal funding cuts. Money runs out today to keep a domestic violence program on Kauai operating. Here to talk about it is editor Noelle Fuji'i Oride. Good morning, Noelle.
Good morning, Catherine.
Well, you know, we've just, you know, been wringing our hands because we know so many nonprofits are affected by these cuts. So what can you tell us about this particular program?
Yeah, so this program, it's called Ho'omanai I Kalahui. It's a program under the YWCA Kauai, and it provided culturally specific and trauma-informed services to those experiencing domestic violence. And while this program did welcome everyone, it especially aimed to reach Kauai's Native Hawaiian communities. About 37% of those participating in the YWCA Kauai's Crisis Services Program identify as Native Hawaiian. The program also sought to reach Pacific Islander and Filipino residents as well, just because they experience higher rates of domestic violence and are often overlooked in mainstream services. And this program, it's only been running for a year, but its funding from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is being cut or has been cut due to federal policy changes that eliminate support for culturally specific programs. So although they've been trying to seek other funding, for now, Ho'omana I Kalahui's last day of operations is today.
Yeah, that's a shame because I'm sure the, you know, I mean, it was a fairly new program. It sounded, you know, according to your story, like if people, you know, really felt comfortable with it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the program director, Kavena Bagano, she was sharing a story with me of a Waimea community member she spoke with when they first opened one of their offices in Waimea, which is next to a Hawaiian homelands community. And that community member just shared that she wished that program was available when she needed it. And, you know, this program, it did have an office in Anahola as well, which is a Hawaiian homelands community. And so it really was about maintaining that presence and getting conversations going and also connecting folks with resources if they did need help.
Well, you know, I know people are keeping their fingers crossed that some kind of funding will come in. You know, not sure where they applied, but yeah, you would just like to hope that there'd be someone to backstop it.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, this program, it really used Hawaiian culture as a foundation for violence prevention and also for healing. And so a large component of it was providing or hosting cultural activity workshops. They did ukulele and ni'ihau shell jewelry making, and they also hosted a couple of community talk story events. And for the ukulele workshops, I mean, those were well-received. I mean, and on a hola, right, they would have maybe a handful to a dozen attendees of all ages. And the teacher of that workshop, she just really saw attendees gain self-confidence and, you know, let loose toward the end of the sessions. And it would basically end with everyone, like, either playing ukulele, singing, or dancing hula. And, you know, Valerie Cabrera, who worked for this program, he said these workshops really gave attendees a haven and a safe place for connection, right? She saw them open up with one another and also lift one another up.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes that connection is just so needed when you're in a crisis situation.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And, you know, the program's leaders, so Kavena and Valerie, they both have family ties in Anahola. And then Kavena, she actually shared that she has some lived experience with violence in her family. And so that experience and then those relationships sometimes made it easier for folks to confide in her and Valerie that they were experiencing domestic violence and just really be a safe place, right, if someone needed help.
Well, we hope that they can find additional funding and they can restart this after it closes today. But thank you so much, Noelle.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Overstory editor Noelle Fuji'i-Oride. Read her story at overstoryhawaii.org. This is The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. For today's Manu Minute, we are spotlighting the domestic rock pigeon, which was introduced to Hawaii more than 200 years ago, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology for these recordings. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Rock pigeons, also known as pigeons, are common throughout Hawaii and are one of the world's best-known birds. Their appearance has been altered by centuries of domestication, but they usually range from light to dark blue-gray, with patches of iridescent purple, blue, or green colors on their feathers. Males and females look the same, but males often have more of the iridescence on their neck, which is caused by the way light is reflected off their feathers, not by any particular feather pigments. Rock pigeons feed mainly on grass seeds, grain, and various food scraps in cities and urban areas. Their primary song is a display coo, which they use to attract their mates and is accompanied by a puffing up of their throat feathers and a series of courtship bows. Certain breeds of pigeons, known as homing or carrier pigeons, have a well-known ability to bring rolled-up messages written on paper back to their home from distant places they've never been. Rock pigeons are native to North Africa and Asia and were first brought to Hawaii in the late 1700s, making them one of our first introduced non-native birds. There have been many introductions since, including those ubiquitous white pigeons found around Waikiki, which may be descendants of birds brought from Canada for the dedication of Kapi'olani Bird Park by King Kalakaua in 1874. While pigeons are loved around the world as pets and also food, their large numbers can make them a public nuisance. Here in Hawaii, they may also be competing with native seabirds such as Noyo for hard-to-find nesting sites along sea cliffs. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, devoted to helping protect the native species that call the refuges their home. FriendsOfOahuNWR.org. Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
A state agency here in Hawaii has begun experimenting with artificial intelligence in a surprising way. The state auditor, Les Kondo, this month launched an AI-generated podcast to summarize his office's reports. The first episode looks at the Cool Classrooms initiative started under Governor David Ige. That program set aside $120 million to install air conditioners and fans to reduce temperatures in our public schools. But an audit found that the Department of Education lacked proper oversight. Take a listen to a clip from the Audible Audit, an AI-generated podcast.
There was this mandate to aim for net zero energy for the state.
The environmental goal.
Exactly. And practically, they really wanted to avoid huge electrical upgrades. That could have cost another $100 million easily.
Okay, so trying to be green and save on infrastructure costs.
Right.
But how did it pan out? The DOE spent about $105 million and only cooled 838 classrooms. That averages out to, what, over $120,000 per room?
That's the number. It's staggering, really. And a lot of those solar AC systems, they either failed right away or just didn't work properly from the get-go.
So more money needed.
Millions more. For salvage, for repairs, sometimes just connecting them to the grid anyway.
And there's that Castle High School example, which is just kind of unbelievable.
Installing solar panels literally under the shade of big monkey pod trees.
It seems so obvious. An engineer pointed out they were getting less than 20% power. The quote was, "It's dark most of the day, and nobody stopped it."
That was part of an AI-generated podcast produced by the Hawaii Auditor's Office. We spoke with Les Kondo, who said he decided to roll out this podcast in an effort at getting more eyes on the report.
What we've done thus far is we have posted an AI-generated podcast of our report about the Department of Education's Cool Classrooms Initiative. That's the $100 million that the legislature had appropriated in 2016 to cool 1,000 classrooms under Governor Ige's initiative to get that done by the end of the calendar year.
Talk about the discussions that you had about using this tool in this way.
Well, internally, we had a lot of discussion, a lot of concern about the accuracy of the podcast. We certainly didn't want to mislead anyone to think that this was not AI-generated. So if you go to our podcast, and we've labeled our podcast library that currently only includes this one podcast as the Audible Audit. But if you go to that podcast, the one that we have posted, there is a introduction that tells people that this is AI-generated. But the content has been reviewed by the office, and the content we stand behind. And that introduction is also AI-generated. But our hope is that it will be another way that people will get information about the work that we're doing, the audits and other reports that we're issuing. We're just trying to push out information through different ways that might get people to understand and maybe eventually read the reports themselves. We do good work. We do really important work, valuable work that provides not only the agency with recommendations as to how to improve their work, but often we're providing transparency into a department's program that many don't have, including legislators, how a program is operating, how they're spending state money, things of that nature.
Well, your office deals with a huge amount of paperwork. And I was listening to the podcast, and to me, it seemed like, well, it's a promo. It's a way to be able to quickly distill what that report is about and hopefully get more eyes on the report once you have their ears.
I hope so. I mean, that's the intent. But we had internal debate, discussion about whether or not this was an appropriate vehicle. And at the end of the day, I decided that it's better than what we have now, which is nothing. So it's just another way or another avenue to get people to learn about what we're doing, learn about our reports. Is it perfect? Maybe not, but it's, to me, it's good enough, and we needed to take that first step to trying to use AI in a way that we think is appropriate. And right now, we're trying to figure out how to use AI in different aspects of our work. We just got to get on that train.
Earlier, we saw one of the local media outlets experiment with avatars on video online using fake anchors, and it was a big experiment. Lots of eyebrows were raised about how appropriate this was, and there were issues about pronunciation of place names, that kind of thing, and for whatever reason, that has ended. But how did you look at that as you were putting this together?
The AI-generated newscast that I think that you're referring to. Initially, when our IT manager had asked me to listen to this AI-generated podcast, I was very wary. I was concerned that it was going to be something like that, but it's not. It's pretty good. And we needed to be sure that it was not something that was similar to what you're referring to, where people would roll their eyes at it after they listened to it. We wanted to make sure that it was something that we could, as an office, stand behind. And before we posted it or put it on our website, we asked people in the office to not only to listen to it, but to take it home, let their family listen to it. We asked friends to listen to it, and we wanted feedback. And we have a biased test crowd, I guess, because it's friends and family, but the feedback was really positive. So once we had that positive feedback, we thought, okay, let's see how it works. And I welcome feedback from people that are listening to this broadcast, and you too, Catherine, both plus positive and negative, and to the extent that we're able to improve it, that would be great. If people think this is just not appropriate, then we would consider that, and maybe we would start taking it down or not doing as many of these.
The work that you do is very serious work. It's important. It helps guide our policymakers about the path that we should be setting on. You certainly don't mince words, and you have documentation to show where we have fallen short on spending taxpayers' money, as an example. But do you worry that this might come across as too simplistic?
That was all part of the consideration, the discussion that we had internally, whether or not this was something that we thought was appropriate for our work and our office. And like I said earlier, at the end of the day, I decided that it was good enough, not perfect. But if you listen to the podcast, it is a conversation between two AI-generated voices, very similar to what you and I are having right now. So if you're familiar with this format, that's the format of the podcast. Two people talking about the report that we issued. And there are comments in there that perhaps if you and I or someone in my office, we were doing a podcast of our report, we might not have included. But it is not to the point where I thought it was over the top or something that we couldn't release to the public.
And so what are the plans to expand it at this point? You have one. What's the rollout plan?
Our plan is to do these podcasts for every report going forward. Audit reports and other kinds of reports, not financial audits, but our performance audits and other reports like the Cool Classrooms report that we issued. Our intent is also to go back and to do podcasts of a handful or a couple handfuls of reports that we issued in the past, some of them many years ago that we think still are relevant, and we think the public might, public and legislators and others might have interest to learn about. The podcast is about 5 or 6 minutes long. So our reports generally are 50 pages long. Even the auditor summary might be 2 or 3 pages long. So like I said earlier, it's just another way that we hope people might be able to learn about the work we did or we do and gain something from that. And if it's of interest to them, maybe they'll go to the report and they'll read the entire report. But we think there's reports that we've issued that are valuable even today, of interest to the public and legislators, and our intent is to go back and do podcasts of those reports as well.
So it'll help give us context as you release your reports.
Another way for people to understand what the report says, what we did, the work that we did, and what our findings are.
That was Hawaii State Auditor Les Kondo. We will have links to the AI-generated podcast and the report on our website later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com. Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health, committed to helping women stay healthy with services including well women exams, pregnancy, heart health, and cancer care. HawaiiPacificHealth.org/womenscenters.
A mural festival. Worldwide Walls, formerly known as Powwow Hawaii, wrapped up this weekend. Artists painted about 50 new murals at Farrington High School, but now some students and alumni of the school are taking issue with some of that artwork. Here to talk about that is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so, wow, 50. That's a lot of murals.
Yeah, a little over 50. And by more than a dozen artists, mostly local artists and led by the founder Jasper Wong. But there were some students and alumni that were not happy with some of the murals. For example, their main concern is that they weren't made aware that these murals were happening and they weren't a part of the process or to even get to know some of these murals and the artists behind these murals. And some murals they weren't not particularly excited about was, for example, a mural of a nene goose dressed as a pirate while flying a spaceship carrying a basket of spam musubi. And another mural is, this was done last year, same by Worldwide Walls, is dinosaurs breaking through the walls, and it says Aloha is not extinct, but it has the wrong school motto where it says go forth and serve, but it's go forth to serve. And Kamakea Wright, who is a 17-year-old senior at Farrington High School, said they were unaware of these murals and what they were about.
I feel like they don't accurately represent Farrington as a community. I'm not saying all of them do that, because there are definitely beautiful murals that are being painted on campus by local artists, but there are also a lot of them that kind of just portray, like, not just Kalihi, but Hawaii in like a weird kind of like touristy light, if you kind of know what I mean. I personally, yeah, like I said, I don't like all of the murals, but some of them are cool. But a majority of them I don't find personally appealing or have like anything to do with Farrington or Kalihi whatsoever, which I'm very disappointed about.
And like they were saying, they liked some of the murals. Like one mural, for example, is located all the way in the back of the campus where Wright said not many students go to and linger around. And it was a mural of, I think, a Native Hawaiian person carrying a powerful spear in this like prominent stature. But Wright and another alumnus that I was talking to for this story is that Farrington is made up of mostly immigrant communities, so Pacific Islander like Micronesian, Samoan, Tongan, Filipinos, and there's a lot of immigrants that are located in Kalihi, and they wanted to, as students, see themselves in these murals to be inspired, since they have to walk on campus Monday through Friday or weekends, depending on study groups and whatnot. But I did talk to Jasper Wong, and he said that the process with the Department of Education and the school administration is a different process, where they had to run the ideas by them. This was a collaboration going back to 2022, and they have a total of 70 murals by Worldwide Walls. And Jasper Wong was telling me that they have to propose the idea to the administration, and the administration has to collaborate with the students and whatnot. And they ultimately approved the idea of the murals, but some of the students still were not made aware of that. But the murals, Jasper said, are not publicly funded.
At the end, like, it's also us trying to balance and walk a fine line between allowing the artists to have creative and artistic freedom because they're donating their time, and we all are, and also doing work that is relevant to the community, but without also having like 100 art directors dictating every aspect of it. And that can always be difficult. And then I know that, you know, working as a culture and arts commissioner for the city, you know, sometimes when we set up too many layers of approval, it can kill projects. And so I was trying to find a fine line where, like, the artists can do work that they're proud of, that don't, and because they're not being commissioned, and doing something that's also loved and relevant to the community and family friendly, et cetera.
And the Department of Education spokesperson, Anaya Ching, did provide a statement to me. And she said that the Farrington High School administration is working on QR codes for students to get to know the project later on in the future when future murals will be painted.
Okay, so there are more to come then.
There is more to come.
All right.
Yeah, more collaboration, hopefully.
Okay, all right. Well, thanks so much. We've been talking to HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio, about the community's response to some new murals painted at Farrington High School. We have some sad news to share. Hawaii Public Radio lost a member of its ohana earlier this week. For more than 20 years, Ian Capps hosted The Early Muse on HPR2. It was a show that showcased 500 years of music from the 12th to 17th centuries. Ian began as a volunteer at HPR, answering phones for our membership campaign way back in 2002. And all of this came after his retirement from an accomplished career as a news executive with Reuters and the global news distributor PR Newswire. Today we remember Ian through a conversation we had with him a few years ago in the days after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II. As we've been hearing all morning, we have lost Queen Elizabeth, the longest-serving monarch in British history. And joining us this morning in studio is HPR's Ian Capps. You may know him as host of Early Muse, a long-running classic music show here on HPR2. But you may not know that before he came to Hawaii Public Radio, he worked for Reuters. And you're from London, Ian.
I am indeed from London. And it's in London that I have my favorite memory of Queen Elizabeth, then just crowned. My sister and I were, I was 11 years old only, and my sister and I were allowed to be on Park Lane, and the soldiers there allowed us to creep through and be in front of them so that we could see this incredible parade of carriages and everything from the coronation. And I still remember the sense of immense hope that this young, wonderfully attractive and very empathetic young lady, were represented the final end of the war, if you like. During the war, she had, as you heard on the news, she had been with her parents when they, unlike many others who would have done it, did not desert London during the course of the war, even during the Blitz, but were always there, and she was always there. The future queen was always there. Being, you know, visiting the disaster areas, encouraging people, and representing the sort of figurehead that she later knew her so well how to complete.
Well, I guess that early memory, though, of being, you know, a young boy and this feeling the excitement of a change and of hope.
That's right. You know, it was, it had been a long time of rationing by then. Rationing was just about to end. There was a tremendous amount of effort to rebuild all of the bombed sites in London, but it was still a heavy feeling this was, you know, everybody regretted the loss of the king, but it was in fact a real boost to morale for going to the future. It was hope for the future, and I sensed that.
And to think that she just reigned for so long and did so much in her life.
Well, one of the things that every time I go back to England and talk to people, one of the things that she still represents is the lack of politics in a leader. She is there, or was there, as a figurehead without any political, you know, with all the nasty political activities going on all over the world. She was not a political appointee. She was independent, and she was always there and never crossed over the boundary into politics.
And so, gosh, you know, as you think back on that day, you know, when you watched her, you know, take the throne, God, did you ever think that she would reign for so long?
No, but when you think of Queen Elizabeth I and of Queen Victoria, they lasted longer than most of the men, all of them.
Mm-hmm. And you were just there in London this summer.
We were just back for the first time in 3 years in London. Yes, but you know, it was not necessarily evident that there would be that she was on the brink of death, but she was 96 already, and her husband. The Duke of Edinburgh had died last year, and that was obviously a blow, because as her own mother, Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, had been the strength behind, and rather nervous initially, and George the VI, and really was there behind the King, so she took that. Prince Philip, or Duke of Edinburgh, took that role as well. He would love to be in the front, but he was always behind her and always in support of her. So it was really a great partnership.
And I guess to think that, yes, she learned how to rule, how to reign because of the upbringing she had with her parents.
That's right. Absolutely, yes. It was a family tradition, and she really represented it to the full. And she was a very, very hard worker all her life.
And so I guess, you know, as you think of your fellow Brits today with the loss, I don't know, any final thoughts?
Well, I think people recognize that it was going to happen, and they are waiting to see how Charles manages to cope with the situation. And I think he will do a good job. He'll do his best.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for joining us today to share your memories of the Queen and the royal family.
Thank you very much for having me, Catherine.
Thank you. And that was a Hanaho of a segment that we did with former HPR host Ian Capps. He passed away earlier this week. Thank you very much for spending time with us today. I'm Catherine Cruz.